Hi, and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. In the final part of our three-part mini-series aimed at newer investors, I'll be talking about asset allocation and portfolio construction with Andrew McCauley, Chief Investment Officer at Credit Suisse Private Bank Australia. The goal for this week's episode is to provide listeners with the information they need to get started in building a diversified portfolio. In this episode, we discuss what asset allocation is and why it matters, the difference between active and passive investing and when to use each one, and he discusses the biggest misconceptions that he sees among investors. If you've got any family members or friends who have been asking you about investing, then this might be for them. Please consider whether you know anyone who might benefit from this content and send it their way. And as always, please subscribe to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and visit our website, livewiremarkets.com, which is free to register for and read. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show. Andrew, welcome to the show. It's good to have you on.
Thank you, Patrick.
As our listeners are no doubt aware, we're now in the third part of our special mini-series for new investors. Today, we're going to be discussing asset allocation and portfolio construction with Andrew McCauley. So let's start at the beginning. Asset allocation and portfolio construction. It's a bit of a mouthful for a new beginner. Let's just talk a bit about what it is. So could you explain to us what it is, first of all, and then why is it so important?
Sure. Well, asset allocation is just referring to what asset classes you will have in your portfolio and in what proportion. There's no real mystery to it. There's two aspects to asset allocation to consider: the long-term strategic asset allocation and the shorter-term tactical. The long-term asset allocation, often referred to as the benchmark or the neutral position, is just what is the asset mix that in the long term will deliver the investor the risk-return profile that they require. Tactical asset allocation is where the investment manager is coming up with shorter-term views. Perhaps it's we're favouring US equities this month. Perhaps it's we're favouring Aussie bonds, whatever it is, and then skewing the portfolio to reflect that view. And portfolio construction is actually filling out each of the asset classes with whatever it is, securities, funds, exchange-traded funds, whatever it is that creates the optimal mix of investments to achieve that asset allocation.
So the strategic asset allocation, if I'm understanding you correctly, that's more about the individual investor and what their investment should look like, whereas the tactical asset allocation, that's more about what's happening in the world today and, you know, might consider where the valuations are and, you know, what some of the drivers are, you know, political or the like.
Yeah, no, that's spot on. And we spend a lot of time working out the strategic asset allocation, because after all the statistics, all the research shows that after about 3 years from starting a portfolio, the return, or 85% of the return, is determined by the mix of assets you have. Whether you've started off with a very growthy portfolio or you've started off with a very defensive portfolio, that really is the most important thing.
So when an investor looks at their, say, their superannuation and they see balanced in there, that would refer to more to their strategic asset allocation then rather than a tactical, but it might have a bit of a tactical overlay there that your super fund has put on top of that. Is that right?
Yeah. So a balanced investor is kind of in the middle. They don't want to be too defensive. They've got a reasonable investment horizon. They're probably looking out 8 or 9 years, but they don't have an investment horizon is that long that they can take on a large amount of risk. So beyond balance, you might look at a portfolio that's called growth. which will have significantly more equities in it. And then you might go a step further and have a portfolio that is just completely equities and which is completely risk on. And what you decide on will depend on a lot of factors, but mostly it'll depend on how you perceive risk and what risk you're willing to take.
I find it interesting that point that you make there about the majority of the returns that an investor gets after the first few years come from their choice of asset allocation. I think the perception amongst a lot of people is probably that, you know, picking the right stocks is very important. Mm. Why do you think that perception exists that, you know, it's all about getting the equities right when really that other driver of what assets you're invested in is actually more important?
Yeah, exactly. Well, the reason it is because all the noise is around day-to-day movements. So you turn on the news, you watch the ABC News and Alan Kohler comes on and he says, well, BHP was up this much and Rio was down this much and the banks did this and the dollar did that. But really, that's just day-to-day noise. The thing that's going to really determine what your return will be after any sort of reasonable time, 5, 6, 7 years, it's that starting point. It's that decision to say, I'm willing to take some risk. For example, I will take a growth portfolio. What does that mean? About 2/3 of the assets are likely to be in equities, international and Aussie, probably something like 15 or 20% in bonds and cash, and around 17, 18, 19% in alternative investments. And that's really what is going to determine the return.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about each of those asset classes that you mentioned. Let's break it down and we'll discuss growth assets and then we'll touch a little bit on the defensive assets. So let's just start by, could you just tell us what each of the major asset classes are and just give us kind of a simple broad definition of them if you can?
Yep, terrific. So the most obvious one, cash is cash. We all know what that is. Bonds, international and Aussie. So bonds, fixed interest instrument. You buy a bond, it has a par value that you receive on maturity of the bond and you receive coupon payments or interest payments while you're holding the bond until maturity. Then we have within equities, international and Aussie equities, and then finally alternatives. And the alternatives, it's a bit of a broad church, if I could put it that way. So alternatives can be hedge funds, it can be commodities, listed property, and then we have the illiquid alternatives, so private equity, unlisted infrastructure, and direct property, for example. And each of them has a different role to play. So bonds, according to our approach and our philosophy, bonds are there for income, so from the coupon payments, and stability. So what you find with bonds is when share markets are panicking and falling precipitously, bonds are doing well. You know, they're returning a positive return as there's a flight to safety. Equities are there to provide growth to a portfolio and dividend yield. So growth, typically you're looking for some sort of GDP plus result from equities. And equities are more volatile, it's just by their nature. We all know, you know, during the GFC, we had equity markets falling by 50%. This year so far, Aussie equities and international equities in Aussie dollars are both up 22%. So you get some really, really large swings. And alternatives are there. They're sort of a bit of a halfway house, if I could put it that way, a halfway house between bonds and equities. Alternatives, the idea is they provide an uncorrelated return, that their sources of return are depending on something that really is not directly linked with where share markets or bond markets are going. So, for example, infrastructure, you own a road, it collects a toll. It really doesn't depend on where the equity market or where the bond market is going. But the return is likely to be lower than equities, but the volatility will be lower as well. And likewise, the return will be better than bonds, but the volatility will be higher. So if I could all wrap it up briefly, alternatives are there to provide a real rate of return better than bonds, but actually provide uncorrelated returns that ultimately will smooth the overall return of the portfolio.
With regards to the bonds that you mentioned there, I'm just curious to talk a little bit about the current situation for bonds. You say that they are there for primarily for income.
Yep.
But if we look at bonds today, the income on offer is very, very low. Should, in a situation like this, I don't want to keep it specific to bonds, but I think it's a really good example.
Yes.
Where a particular asset class might go well outside what the range of what is considered, you know, normal.
Yes.
Would you consider changing that up, and maybe would an investor maybe want to have a look at some alternatives, for lack of a better term,
yeah,
to bonds in an environment where they're really not paying a lot of, yeah, a lot,
sure,
of interest?
No, that's, we're spending a lot of time at the moment talking to clients about, you know, they're raising the same question. Why are we holding bonds? What's the point? The 10-year bond yield in Australia is 1.18%. That seems quite low. A bit higher in the States, it's at 1.8%, 1.85. But there's a dual role for bonds in the portfolio. Yes, one of them is income. And as I said, it is low at the moment. And if you're investing in bonds, well, firstly, it's not the 10-year bond that you will get, the 10-year government bond. That's the worst case scenario. There's more than one way to skin a cat. Okay, so there's all sorts of bond investments, corporates, higher yielding bonds that'll give you a better return than that. So don't think that when you're investing in bonds, you're just getting 1.18%. But you have to acknowledge that in the market today, bonds will be providing a much lower yield for the next 12 months or whatever than they have in the past. You just have to accept that. But the other aspect, or the other reason for bonds in a portfolio, is capital stability. And we've done a lot of work on this. And even with bond yields so low, we asked ourselves, what happens if there's a sell-off in the equities market? Will bonds still provide us with that capital stabilization? Will bonds still appreciate in value as they have in the past? The short answer is yes. We've looked at the statistics. We looked at in the Australian market, every time there was a sell-off in the last 30 years in equities of 10% or close to, what did bonds do? Every time bonds had a positive return. And even in the last quarter of 2019, when bond yields, admittedly, they were higher than what they are now, they were around 2%.
Sorry, did you mean 2018 or 2019 there?
In 2018, sorry.
Yeah, okay. No worries. Yeah.
So in the Q4 2018, when we had that massive share sell-off, even with bond yields below, Aussie bond yields rose. So they're still doing their job. And I'll just finish, Patrick. I'll just give you one other statistic. So Switzerland, so we're a Swiss bank. And I asked my colleagues, I said, because they've been dealing with negative bond yields since 2015. They've had negative cash rates since 2011. So I asked them, I said, well, okay, yields are negative. We're not talking 1.18% like they are here. We said yields are negative in Switzerland since 2015. So whenever there's a sell-off in equities in Switzerland, I asked my colleagues, what's happened? And they said, well, funny enough, bonds have done well. So what happens is they just got more negative in yield. So look, I think in Australia, there is still yield to be had, and all the data points to bonds continuing to act as that capital stabilizer for when there's a sell-off in equities. I tell you, if we get another GFC tomorrow, you won't be saying, gee, bonds have got a yield of 1.18%. That's pretty poor. You'll be saying, wow, why didn't we have more bonds?
Yeah, that's a really good point about the Swiss bonds. I was actually just looking at them this morning, and I saw that the 50-year bond is now a negative yield, which,
yeah,
it's pretty hard to wrap your head around. But just before we move on from this subject, I just wanted to quickly explain a couple of the terms that we used earlier, just in an effort to try and keep this as simple as we can. So one of the terms that was used was par value, which, of course, when you buy a bond, it is actually a security that you're going onto a public market and you're purchasing. That bond might have a face value of, say, $100, just for the sake of argument. So that's usually what they would refer to as the par value, yeah?
That's right. Par or face value.
It's just or face value.
The money that you get back at the end
exactly,
of the day.
Exactly, yeah. Whereas the coupon is the actual interest that you're being paid. Now, I know this is an unrealistic scenario today, but just for the sake of argument,
a bond might look like a $100 face value with, say, a 5% coupon. That means you're going to get, a $5 coupon, which means you're going to get a 5% yield every year for as long as you hold that, which might be 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, could be 10 years or even longer.
That's right.
Well, let's stay on the topic of asset allocation. This particular podcast is aimed at younger investors. So we're trying to talk about people who are probably fairly new to investing. They might have been doing it for a little while, but probably not as experienced as as yourself and people in the industry. And so when somebody's a bit younger, say 25 to 30, what might a typical asset allocation look like for a person like that?
So 25 to 30, definitely got an investment horizon more than 12 years. So definitely in the growth camp, perhaps even an equities only portfolio with a little bit of alternatives in it. So just depends how the person, even at a young age, people have different views on what risk is and how it affects them. So probably if we look at the growth portfolio, 2/3 equities, about 20% bonds, and the rest in alternatives. I think it's quite nice to have the ability or the option to invest in bonds, even when you have a long investment horizon, because crises happen. And all the data shows and the research that we've done that if you can protect the downside, the upside will look after itself. So what that means is if you get another GFC, all portfolios will be down. But the more bonds you have, the quicker you will get back to your starting point. You will recover your returns much quicker. And we've found that if you're efficient at that, that ultimately that you might give a little bit of return away because you have a more conservative position, but it's not very much. You know, in terms of the risk that you're reducing in your portfolio, we would say it's worth it. But there are some, you know, plenty of people who at a young age think, not interested in bonds, I understand volatility in equities, and, you know, let's go limit up risk. But we would still counsel them to not just Aussie equities, international as well, and do have some exposure to hedge funds and the likes in the alternative space.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned how two very similar investors might have different risk appetites. My partner and I, we're the same age. We both work in the finance industry. We've both got similar experience with investing, but we both have different attitudes towards risk. Mm. And whilst I'm quite comfortable taking a large amount of risk, she's a bit more risk averse. And it, you know, on paper, you might think that the two of us should have a very, very similar risk profile, but once you actually delve into it, there's some differences there, which I think is an interesting illustration of the point you made.
Yeah, we show clients or when clients come in and we go through this process, there's different ways to measure risk, and we show them different measures. So there's just standard deviation or volatility around, you know, what's the average return. And on average, you know, what's the swing around that return? Also, how often you can expect a negative year. That's an interesting one. But the one that seems to get most attention is what did this portfolio do during the GFC? You know, did it drop 30% or 40%? And then we ask the question, if it dropped 40%, could you cope with that? Because the worst thing that can happen is if an investor sells at the bottom. If an investor is comfortable with a 40% drawdown or a fall, and that's fine, life goes on, they don't worry about it, they don't sell, that's exactly what we're trying to achieve. They're in the right risk profile. But if someone, they wake up in the morning, the market's dropped 40% and they're ringing us up and they're saying, sell everything, we know we haven't done our job. We haven't educated them around the risks in the portfolio.
Yeah, I loss aversion is often talked about as being cognitive bias, but I find it interesting that I'm not actually sure that it is. When you look at it mathematically, losses do actually hurt more than gains benefit you. If you lose 50% of your funds, you then have to get 100% returns to get back to where you started. So when you look at it, when you break it down, losses do actually hurt more. So you got to question whether that is actually a bias or whether whether that's actually the appropriate way to think about it. Maybe investors should be thinking about the losses, which goes to what you were saying before about, you know, wanting to protect the downside there.
That's right. Look, we don't think another GFC is going to happen, you know, in the next 5 years. I mean, it could. We're always asking ourselves, what if we're wrong? But if it does, and you just happen to time it, you know, you haven't been in the market before and you just happen to invest on the day before the next GFC hits, that's going to cause you a lot of pain. You will get your returns back eventually, but there'll be some sleepless nights in between times. So, yep, absolutely, protect the portfolio. Think about, what if I'm wrong? How do I protect the portfolio before you put a dollar in the market?
Well, let's move on and talk a bit about active and passive management. So I'll start just by explaining what we mean by that, and then we can get into the question. So there's traditionally funds managers have taken what we would call an active approach to investing. They will take a universe, say in Australia, of 300 stocks, and they will go out and they'll analyze and assess a large number, if not all of those stocks, and make a decision as to which are the most attractive ones to invest in. There are lots of different approaches to how to do that, but that's what we mean when we say active investment. It usually involves paying a higher fee than the alternative, but the goal is to try and perform better than average, which is actually quite challenging to do. On the other hand, you have passive investment, which is, I think, more of a recent trend, relatively speaking. And passive investment essentially says, look, we don't know how to get better than average. So rather than taking the risk of doing worse than average, we're just going to buy basically everything, or the equivalent of buying everything. We're going to buy the average and do it as cheaply as we can so that you can get as close to that average as possible. And these days you can actually do that very cheaply. So that's the context. That's what we mean when we say active and passive management. So on to the question, what situations would you consider active management to be more appropriate? And when might you consider using passive management instead?
Yep, sure. So we use active management where it makes sense. We're agnostic. You know, when we're putting a portfolio together, we don't care if it's a fund manager, an external fund manager, an internal model portfolio, and an exchange traded fund, which is a fund that is passive and tracks whatever the benchmark is, be it the S&P 500 or the ASX 200. There's no brain work involved. It just tracks the performance of it. So we just use whatever we think makes sense. We'll use an active manager, as I said, where it makes sense. And that's usually in markets where it looks like an information advantage can be achieved, or the market is not completely efficient. And I'd use the example of emerging markets. So in emerging markets, we find at the moment that there are active managers that can outperform the benchmark, the MSCI emerging markets index, that they can do it. So that makes sense. In the States, however, it's completely different. It's ultra competitive. It's ultra transparent. There is no information advantage. So 85% or 90% of managers in the last 10 years have not outperformed the S&P 500. And so what do? We don't use active managers. We buy, to get exposure to the US, well, we do a couple of things. We anchor it in an exchange traded fund in the S&P 500. Costs us nothing, not, you know, 5 basis points, 6 basis points or whatever it is. And we combine that with a technology exposure achieved through buying the NASDAQ exchange traded fund. So here's a scenario for you. If you just held that combination, S&P 500 and NASDAQ exchange traded fund, you've outperformed 85% of managers for the last 10 years in the States. But we also augment that. We have particular sector views that we like to implement in the portfolio. But again, we'll tend to use exchange traded funds that track a particular sector, whether it be healthcare or, as it is at the moment, we like the financials. So we use an exchange traded fund that tracks those.
I just wanted to explain what a basis point is. It's actually, it's pretty straightforward, really. It's simply 0.01%. So yeah, when we say 5 basis points, what we mean is 0.05%.
Correct, yeah.
And if you can invest a large sum of money for 0.05% per annum, that's incredibly cheap.
That's right. It's cheap. And as we've found out over many, many, many years in certain markets, why pay 0.6% or 0.7% for some active manager when you can have an exchange-traded fund that does better and there's no brain work involved, it's just tracking the market.
It's interesting that you go to 0.6 or 0.7% because if we go back 15 years, the standard in the industry was to pay, 2% of your assets each year plus a 20% performance fee. I think potentially one of the really major benefits that everybody, whether you're into active management, passive management or both, but everybody has benefited from except maybe the fund managers themselves, from the fall in fees over the last 10 or 15 years. Push towards passive management seems to have put a lot of pressure on those active managers to get those fees down, making it a bit more.
We're happy to pay a fee if it's value for money. I was interested to see the Future Fund talking about this with regards to hedge funds. And they said, we're happy to pay 2% base fee and a 20% performance fee. But if we think the manager's adding value, and we've got the same approach.
Well, let's move on from these kind of specific questions. I've got some broader questions that I'd love to hear your take on. I have no doubt that you meet with a lot of different investors from all different walks of life. Everyone, I imagine, from very, very experienced investors in working at institutions through to fairly new investors who, might have come into money and trying to work out what to do with it. So looking broadly across the different types of investors you encounter, what is one of the big misconceptions that you come across regularly?
Probably the biggest misconception is that investing has to be complicated. And I guess, we've been throwing around a bit of jargon, a balanced portfolio, a growth portfolio, benchmark, all this type of thing. And what's a balanced portfolio and what's a growth portfolio? If you're thinking about if you have an average sort of risk profile and you probably would fall into a balanced bucket, you could just buy an exchange-traded fund that tracks the Aussie bond market, and you could buy an exchange-traded fund that tracks the Aussie equities market, and then all of a sudden you've got a balanced portfolio. So it doesn't have to be complicated. But the second misconception I would point out, the concept that particularly for people learning to invest and starting out in Australia is that international equities are risky, that they're somehow risky. I don't know a lot about them. I'm not sure. Okay, they're not. And in fact, if you combine Aussie equities and international equities, the risk in your portfolio reduces. And that's because international equities, making sure that you're unhedged, meaning that you're just taking the foreign currency moves as they come. You might invest in some US equities. But what happens is when there's a big sell-off in share markets, the Aussie dollar tends to sell off as well, because we're seen as a growth engine for the world. We're iron ore and coal and all the rest of it. And when the world catches cold, we catch the flu. So the idea, our dollar would come off then. But what that means is for an Australian investor, my investment in Microsoft or Apple or whatever it is, all of a sudden the Aussie dollar's falling. And then when I translate the value of my Microsoft shares back, it's better. It acts as a stabilizer. So, not to make too long a story out of it, but basically everything shows combining international equities and Aussie equities actually smooths return in a portfolio. And our research shows that the return of combining both, even taking into account franking credits, the return is about the same, like of having just Aussie equities. So it's well worthwhile in terms of, because you're reducing the risk, to have both in your portfolio.
Yeah, I think I'm glad that you mentioned franking credits, which, look, I think most Australians are probably familiar with it following the recent election and all the discussion of franking credits then. But So I don't want to get into it too much, but let's just, for the sake of discussion, say that it's a tax benefit that you get sometimes from investing in Australian shares when you receive a dividend. It seems to me, and I'm curious to see if you agree, that a lot of Australian investors, their bias towards investing at home does come off the back of the benefit of those franking credits. So if I'm understanding you correctly, you're actually saying that even with the franking credits, even when you include them, the two are pretty even over the long term.
It is. And we always laugh, you know, we sort of say, okay, we've done hours and hours and days of analysis, and we think the split between Australian and international equities should be 50-50. You know, but actually when you look at the benefit you get from a reduction in risk and how the return metrics come out over a long period of time, the actual optimal weight in each is 50-50. It's incredible. So when you factor in franking credits and the return of the Aussie market, and then you got the return of international and how the currency moves over a very long period of time, it's about 50-50.
What would you say is the biggest risk that you're seeing in markets today? What should investors actually be watching out for?
Yeah, there's a lot of conversations around, you know, you alluded to it earlier about how bond yields have fallen quite dramatically, and clients are asking us, well, I want to get my yield up. How do I get my yield up? And they're quoting to us people that are approaching them, particularly the higher net wealth and ultra high net wealth. And they're hearing about these funds that are investing in higher yielding instruments, it might be mezzanine debt, which is basically debt that is lower down in terms of security, so it has a higher yield. Debt to developers, debt to low rated companies, so companies that don't have strong balance sheets. So in the chase for yield, we're seeing more people getting interested in some of these riskier debt funds or, you know, debt instruments, and that's a concern. That's a concern because, you know, things are fine until they're not. So if we start getting some sort of, some sort of significant slowdown in the world economy, becomes more difficult for businesses. If we get a slowdown in residential housing, that's a different story. It looks like it's recovering. But if we were wrong and things turned around dramatically, then these interest-paying investments that investors think are safe, they won't be. The other thing we're very concerned about, there's some exchange-traded funds being issued where they have daily liquidity because they're listed, but the underlying, what they invest in, they couldn't sell them in a day. You know, so some of these high-yielding, high-risk debt instruments or debt issues, it would take them some time to sell it. So if we got some sort of GFC scenario again and investors are going into the market trying to sell their exchange trader fund over these things, the provider or whoever's managing that fund, they won't be able to sell them quick enough. They won't be able to sell the instruments. And you know what? During the GFC, there won't be any buyers anyway. So that's a concern. There's a few of these things around.
You've been around the markets for a little while. I imagine you picked up a few good tips and rules of thumb along the way. What's your favorite rule of thumb that's served you pretty well most of the time as an investor?
Yeah, that's a hard one. I've got a couple, but if I had to generalize, it would be that good companies tend to stay good and bad companies tend to stay bad. So when you look back, so I've been investing since the early 90s, and I look back to the companies we were talking about then, and we're still talking about them, the good ones, you know, so CSL, ResMed, Macquarie, Microsoft, Apple, you know, we were still talking about these companies back then, and we're talking about them now as quality companies with a defensible moat, you know, this phrase that's very trendy to throw out there. Does the company have a moat? Do they have some sort of niche or dominance in a market that can't be, you know, that they can defend, is the idea behind that. So that's probably the most significant rule of thumb that I would have.
Yeah, Microsoft, isn't it a wonderful example? I've never seen another business that's been able to reinvent itself so many times, so successfully. You know, it went from being a company that sold software for desktop computers to a company that, you know, was primarily office software, and these days it's primarily, or maybe not primarily, but largely it's a cloud business.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the most exciting part of the business now, is the cloud computing aspect to it. You know, you're right, they've reinvigorated and changed themselves many times, and Apple's done the same thing.
Be interesting to see if Apple can reproduce that success again in the future without Steve Jobs.
Yes, that's right. He's a pretty inspirational person by all accounts, with some weaknesses.
Look, I've got a few regular questions that I like to ask all my guests. I modified them a little bit to suit the purposes of this mini series, but let's jump into them now. We've got a few minutes left. Could you recommend a good book for someone who's just getting started as an investor? Something to really sink their teeth into and help them get their head around some of the basics and principles.
Well, that's a good question. So for someone who's really just new to it and really starting from the ground up, the book I'll mention is The Barefoot Investor. And the reason I mention that is that my daughter won it as a school prize for business studies. And I hope I'm not sounding like I'm bragging about my daughter. But anyway, so I was flicking through it and I thought, you know what, this is sort of some sensible stuff here, some basic sensible stuff. So I thought that was pretty good. But otherwise, if you're a little bit, you know, if you want to go a little bit more up the intellectual scale, you know, a lot of people quote Warren Buffett, and there's plenty of books that look at how he's done things, and you know, you can find some book about Warren Buffett and read up on him and bore your friends with Warren Buffett quotes over the dinner table. You know, it's very trendy to quote Warren Buffett in investment markets. But if I had to recommend one book to someone who knew a little bit about markets, then that book would be The Big Short by Michael Lewis. So, and they made a movie about it. I don't know if you remember. It came out a few years ago.
Yep.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
So The Big Short is about how the GFC started and how the American residential, you know, the property market, the massive bubble that was built, and how it all unfolded. And it was just looking back on it, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, it's just incredible how it happened and how all these big, big institutions were party to it.
Yeah, look, it's an absolutely wonderful book. The topic of Michael Lewis, the author, has come up on this podcast
a few times before,
okay. And he's absolutely one of the most engaging and enjoyable writers in financial markets, I think. He gets so deep into the subjects, but at the same time, he presents it in a way that is really easy to understand for average people. I think I can't recommend his writing highly enough.
Yes, no, he's very good at what he does.
One last question for you. If you could go back in time and give your 25-year-old self one piece of investing advice, what would it be?
That would be a crisis means opportunity. So if you get a crisis, everything's getting thrown out of the bathtub. So good stocks, good bonds, bad bonds, they're all getting thrown out. And if I could have my time over again, you know, if we got another GFC event, if you want to really make a difference to your net wealth, is to be brave and to buy companies or securities, as long as you understand it and you really know, actually there's nothing wrong with this company, it's just getting caught up in the fear sell-off, then buy it. And I'll give you an example. We had a couple of clients when the GFC was unfolding. We had a couple of clients come in and say, you know what, we think central banks will step in and stop this. We want to buy mortgage-backed securities. So that was like mortgage-backed securities was ground zero for the global financial crisis. Nobody wanted them. They were securities that were backed by hundreds of individual mortgages, which at that time probably 50% of them were going to go under. But they were trading at 10 cents in the dollar or whatever it was back then. So we had some very smart clients come in and say, we think it's time to step up. And they did very well, but well enough that it made, you know, a difference, a real difference. So that would be the thing. Be brave when everyone else is not.
It's easy to say when That's we're sitting right. here from the comfort of all-time high exactly. stock markets, but when the day comes that everything's down 30-40%, it's very tough to actually put it into action, isn't it?
Well, that's right, and you don't know how long you'll have to wait before you start seeing a profit on it. And Murphy's Law says that you will buy it, you won't get the bottom. It'll be down the next day.
Nobody rings a bell at the top or the bottom.
No, that's right, exactly.
Well, Andrew, look, thanks so much for coming on the show today. It's been great to hear your thoughts, and thanks for sharing your wisdom with us.
Great. Thanks for having me, Patrick.